Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Neumann.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.
From global current affairs to art, science, and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 9th of November, these are our main stories. The Israeli military says 50,000 Palestinians have fled on foot from Gaza City during a five-hour pause in its offensive against Hamas militants. In Brazil, an alleged plot to attack Jews has been foiled after the arrest of two suspects with supposed links to the militant group Hezbollah. And Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, is the latest member of his family to give evidence at a civil fraud trial in New York. Also in this podcast,
Mowgli's owner, Michelle Rose, said she'd almost given up hope of finding him alive.
So how did they find the cat stuck 30 metres below ground in a mineshaft? Find out later. We start, though, with the war in Israel and Gaza. Israel's military says 50,000 Palestinians have left Gaza City after Israeli forces opened the main road, Salah el-Din Street, which leads to the south of the Gaza Strip. The chief military spokesman, Daniel Hagari, said a limited pause of 5 hours on Wednesday was not a ceasefire. The IDF continues its offensive against Hamas in Gaza. Hamas is a designated terror organisation by many Western governments, including the UK and the US. Speaking through a translator, Mr. Hagari said Israeli forces would continue to encourage people to leave the Gaza City area and added that Hamas has lost control in the north of the territory.
Hamas has lost control and continues to lose control in the north of the Gaza Strip. Hamas leadership is detached. It is sitting inside bunkers and they are detached from the general Gazan population.
Well, Hamas officials said at least 19 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike on a house near a hospital in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza on Wednesday. As we heard earlier, many people are fleeing south, but some have been telling the BBC that they've been unable to leave. Khaled is an aid worker in the Jabalia refugee camp, and he's sheltering in his home with his own and several other families, over 30 people in all. He sent the BBC this voice message because the internet connection is too unstable for a mobile call.
They are bombing them. They prevent anyone to move. Many friends and many families who trying and bought white flag above the cars and trying to move from this way, they are bombing them. And many times they are trying to move, but they are both checkpoints at this border, military checkpoints, and becomes a prisoner. I have a friend, he moved with his family at the car and bought white flag. They are bombing them. And leave his car and running with his family to take any shelter from the bombing. After 2 days, he back for the north of Gaza Strip.
Well, in another development, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has appeared to dismiss reports that Hamas may be willing to release a dozen hostages in exchange for a pause in fighting of up to 3 days. He insisted there can be no ceasefire without the release of hostages. It was not clear if he meant all 240 hostages must first be released, though. Well, Christian Fraser, my colleague, spoke to the BBC's diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams, who's in Jerusalem, and began first by asking him about the Israeli offensive in Gaza and the attack on the Jabalia refugee camp.
We're seeing a really intense squeezing of that whole area by the Israeli military. You know, so intent are they on uprooting Hamas that pretty much everything so far is being destroyed as they move forward. They haven't yet reached places like Jabalia, which is still, by the sound of it, being hit by some kind of airstrike, or indeed the centre of Gaza City. But when those moments come, we are going to see, you know, increasing levels of destruction. What the Israelis will be somewhat relieved to see over the last couple of days is this gradually increasing number of people who have decided not to stay but to flee. The Israelis have managed to secure that corridor, that road south from Gaza City towards the southern part of the Gaza Strip. It is now secure enough. A couple of days ago it wasn't. There was fighting on that road. It's now secure enough for people to make their way south. And so that's why I think we're seeing these numbers picking up. Some slight dispute about how many, whether it's 40 or 50,000, but it is obviously a significant number of people on the move. But there are an awful lot of people still who are in Gaza City. And that's why I think we're seeing the Israelis not moving at a very fast pace, but trying to be rather methodical, although extremely destructive in the process.
There was some reporting today, Paul, comes from a BBC source who is in touch with those negotiating the release of the hostages, that there is a plan on the table maybe to release 12 hostages, half of them Americans, in exchange for a three-day humanitarian pause. Do you know any more about that and what the sticking points might be?
I mean, this report has been around for a day or two now, Christian, and it sort of comes in and out of focus in a rather tantalising way. I suspect the problem is that three-day figure. I do not detect any desire on the part of the Israeli government to pause for that long to allow anything to unfold. As far as the Israeli government is concerned, that is an opportunity for Hamas to regroup, rearm, arrange their forces and get ready for the next Israeli assault. And they simply do not want to give Hamas any opportunity to do that. We are seeing the Israelis starting to adopt this humanitarian pause terminology, which the Americans have been pushing for some time. They called that window of opportunity of 4 or 5 hours today for people to leave. They called that a humanitarian pause. The Americans, when they were proposing it, were talking about the provision of aid and possibly progress on hostages. It's obviously, as far as the Israelis are concerned today and yesterday, being used for a rather different purpose, which is to allow civilians to leave. But for whatever reason, we are seeing some temporary, short-term, localized pauses to allow the civilians to leave, which obviously serves Israel's tactical and strategic interests in the long run.
Paul Adams reporting from Jerusalem. Well, our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has been embedded with Israeli troops inside Gaza. His movements during an accompanied trip on Wednesday were controlled by the Israel Defense Forces. He sent this report describing what he'd seen.
The Israeli army took our BBC team close to Gaza City in an armoured vehicle on condition that my reporting did not give away military positions. We also had to agree to military censorship of video material, though not this radio report. We travelled through an area that had been left a wasteland after a month of airstrikes and just over a week of a ground invasion. I didn't see a single building that wasn't badly damaged or destroyed. I also didn't see a single Palestinian civilian. There were spasmodic blasts of Israeli tank shells and bursts of machine gun fire. The Israelis took us to a wrecked three-story building in the remains of a big housing development. On a ground sheet, they spread out components they said were partly assembled drones that were designed to bomb them. Then they showed off two floors of workshops. The military called it a terror factory. On the third floor of the badly damaged building was a family apartment, including a bedroom with three pink child's beds, as well as dolls and other toys. The deputy commander of the 4th Armoured Brigade, Lieutenant Colonel Ido, I'm not permitted to use his full name, said that was proof that Hamas used Palestinian civilians as human shields. When I asked the Lieutenant Colonel about the thousands of civilians who've been killed in Israeli strikes in Gaza, he rejected any suggestion that the Israel Defense Forces, as the military is known here, was responsible.
The IDF does not aim to kill innocent people. There's Hamas all over. It's hard to identify the Hamas. I've been shot before an hour and a half. An RPG hit my tank before an hour and a half. From nowhere. They came from a tunnel, tried to kill me. If I see civilians here, I'll do all that is in my power not to harm them.
The visit to Gaza left two overriding impressions. The first is the vast amount of military power Israel has brought in to fight the ground war. I saw many troops and tanks. The second is the level of destruction. It will be extremely difficult for anyone to return to live in the wrecked districts I was able to see. It was on the same level of destruction that I witnessed in the wars in Syria and Ukraine.
Jeremy Bowen reporting from an area close to the outskirts of Gaza City. Well, while the world's attention has been on the situation in Gaza and southern Israel over the past month, lives are also being lost in the West Bank, occupied by Israel since 1967. The UN says at least 150 Palestinians have been killed in the area since October the 7th. The majority of them were civilians, and they included at least 44 children. Some of those who died were at the hands of armed Jewish settlers whose presence is illegal under international law. The UN says three Israelis have also been killed in Palestinian attacks. Our correspondent John Donison has been to the northern West Bank to hear about what's happening there. Some of you may find some elements of his reporting distressing.
This war is not only being fought in Gaza. We went to this funeral in the West Bank town of Tulkarm for four militants killed by Israel this week. Gunmen fire into the air. There's anger and defiance, but also grief and fear of what's to come.
Even before the war, the West Bank was at boiling point, and the fury of what's happening in Gaza, as well as Israel's crackdown on militants here, as well as civilians, has seen the temperature rise to a whole new level. It's a dangerous moment.
We've been refugees in this camp for 75 years, says this 82-year-old. Everyone has just been laughing at us. Hussein, who tells us he works as an electrician, is also among the mourners.
The stress on the people, the cut the streets, cut the cities, kill people, kill children. Everything is stress.
Does it feel like war here as well?
Maybe. Maybe in 2 months they'll stand the war here in the West Bank with Gaza. Yeah, it's connected. There is no Gaza and the West Bank. It's all Palestine.
And in parts of the West Bank over the last month, it's already looked like war. Israel, it says, targeting terrorists, including from Hamas, who are fighting back. Israel has been using bulldozers to rip up the streets, it says, as punishment for Palestinian attacks. They came and destroyed the camp, and then they came again with bulldozers, a young boy tells us. It's always like this, he says. Israeli raids of Palestinian towns and villages are happening night and day. Taha Mahamid was just 15 when he was shot dead by an Israeli soldier. His sister looked on in horror as she recorded on her phone the moment of his death. And the UN says the majority of Palestinians being killed in the West Bank are civilians, including children. But they're suffering not just at the hands of the Israeli army, but also armed Jewish settlers. In this video, documented by the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, a settler shoots a Palestinian at point-blank range amid the olive groves. In the background, an Israeli soldier looks on. Palestinians say Israel allows settlers to act like a militia with impunity. For some, it's become too much. Mohammed Khaled's family has farmed sheep in the occupied West Bank for generations. But this week, they were packing up to leave.
We have lost our land because we couldn't confront them. We escaped out of fear. No one was there to protect us.
Land has always been at the heart of this decades-long conflict. And Palestinians are losing.
John Donison reporting from the northern part of the West Bank. Well, let's stay with a development related to the conflict, because Israel's foreign spy agency, Mossad, has said that it has helped foil an alleged plot to launch attacks on the Jewish community in Brazil. According to the Brazilian authorities, two men arrested in Sao Paulo appear to have links to the Lebanon-based Islamist group Hezbollah. Katie Watson reports from Sao Paulo.
According to a statement issued by Brazil's federal police, the operation in which two suspects were arrested was designed to stop terrorist preparations and obtain information on possible recruitment of Brazilians to commit extremist acts within the country. Recruiters face charges of involvement in a terrorist organisation and participating in preparations for terrorist acts, charges that carry a maximum sentence of 15 and a half years. According to the Israeli Prime Minister's office, Mossad worked with Brazilian and other international spy agencies. It was apparently a network that spanned several countries.
Katie Watson in Brazil. Still to come.
Ivan Minaev, he goes by the name of Holiday Boy, starts with an X. He was criticised by the head of a government-backed censorship body.
Mystery surrounds the health of a Russian social media figure who was conscripted into the army days after being criticised by the authorities.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Newman.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.
The mountains have some energy. When you go there, this energy goes inside you.
Amazing sports stories. Global tales that you may never have heard of, but probably won't forget.
Runners have seen everything, from a family of abominable snowmen to a massive slug, or feeling like being on the edge of a cliff.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, Ukraine is a step closer to starting the process of joining the European Union, and the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has welcomed the news. But it is likely to be a long, long process. We heard more on that from our Brussels correspondent, Sofia Batitsa.
It is very significant in the sense that this brings Ukraine one step closer to joining the European Union, which is something that Kyiv really wants. Now, today in Brussels, the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said that Ukraine made excellent progress even during a war, and it said that it implemented more than 90% of the reforms that are needed to join the EU. And, you know, this will be very good news for President Zelensky, because he said that this positive decision today will give fresh motivation to his troops that are fighting Russia, especially at a time when there are concerns about Ukraine fatigue because of everything that is going on in the Middle East. But in reality, the EU is facing a bit of a dilemma because on one hand, they want to send a strong, positive political signal to the Ukrainian people. You know, I spoke to an EU diplomat who told me that if Ukraine does not join the EU, Ukraine will be lost to Russia. So this is very important for the EU. But on the other hand, you know, it will be very challenging to bring in a country that is currently at war. You know, Ukraine is one of the most heavily mined countries countries in the world. It's awash with weapons, and about 18% of its territory is currently controlled by Russia. So in reality, yes, today a very strong political message from the EU, but in reality, joining the European Union is a very long and complicated process that could take about 10 years. So it could take a long time before Ukraine finally becomes a member of the European Union.
Sofia Batitsa reporting. There's mystery surrounding the health of a prominent Russian social media figure who was conscripted into the army just days after his content was criticised as pro-Ukrainian by the Russian authorities. The TikTok star Ivan Minaev appeared to collapse and lose consciousness on stage in the southern city of Stavropol. A little earlier, he'd been handed a summons to join Russia's army. Vitaly Shevchenko of BBC Monitoring tried to make sense of the story.
Ivan Minaev, who goes by the name of Holiday Boy, starts with an X. He was criticised by the head of a government-backed censorship body. So its head, Ekaterina Mizulina, said that he was pro-Ukrainian, and it's true that on social media, Ivan Minaev described himself as a Ukrainian, and he hails from Crimea, which is a part of Ukraine annexed by Russia, and he described the whole conflict between Russia and Ukraine as pointless. So, 2 weeks after that, a video emerged where he was handed a summons to visit a military conscription office. 2 days ago, on the 6th of November, another video emerged from his concert where he stopped singing, dropped the microphone, dropped to his knees, collapsed on his back and had to be carried off stage. And also importantly, some of his shows were cancelled.
Conscription in Russia, just give us a very brief picture, if you can, of what the situation there is and what the feeling among particularly young men is about it.
You would understand why he should be worried, because reports emerge today that people who are being conscripted into the army and are likely to be forced to fight in Ukraine, they may have to keep on fighting there until the end of what's known as the special military operation in Ukraine. So indefinitely, and that's a terrifying prospect because for many of them, chances of survival are pretty slim.
Let's go to the United States now, where another member of Donald Trump's family has been appearing in court. Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and one-time senior advisor, is the latest of his children to give evidence in New York at the civil trial over alleged fraud at their family company. She isn't a defendant, though, unlike her father and his two eldest sons. Before Ms. Trump was in court, the prosecutor Letitia James had this to say.
Ms. Trump will do all that she can to try to separate herself from this corporation, but she's inextricably tied to the Trump Organization and to these properties that she helped secure financing for.
Well, for more, I spoke to our correspondent, Neda Torfik, who is outside the court. Ivanka Trump is not a defendant this time round, and I asked her, why is she in court then?
She was a defendant until an appeals court took her off, saying the claims against her were just too old on the statute of limitations. So she was a part of the original complaint. And so as a witness, the judge thinks that she has these links that are important to explore. And in particular, it's her involvement in negotiating and securing financing with Deutsche Bank for properties including Trump Doral Golf Resort in Miami and the old post office in Washington, D.C. that became another Trump hotel. And after her husband, Jared Kushner, introduced her to someone at Deutsche Bank, she was able to get interest rates on loans very low because they required a personal guarantee from Donald Trump and evidence that he had a minimum net worth. And so prosecutors say that Trump's statements of financial condition were central to those loans. And remember, those statements are what they said contained those fraudulent valuations. And they say that those loans saved him hundreds of millions of dollars. And Ivanka knows exactly the kinds of conversations that went on with those banks.
So just give us an idea of what it was actually like in the court from what you've seen. I mean, her father the other day, it was bombastic. It was theatrical. He got told off by the judge. What was it like with her?
Very different in terms of tone. I mean, she is trying to come off as being, you know, very cooperative. She's smiling brightly. She's being extremely kind to the judge and the court, answering questions in an even tone. But what has been so striking is just how often she answers questions with "I do not recall," which as a high high-ranking executive, when she is shown the evidence, she will even go back and say, each time she is asked, you know, does this refresh your recollection, seeing the emails that you have with these banks? And she continues to say, I do not recall. So clearly, Ivanka Trump has decided that even though prosecutors have this evidence and have been able to introduce it because she is a witness, that she either doesn't really recall or does not plan to give them any extra ammunition for their case.
Neda Torfik in New York City. Next, Bangladesh, the world's second biggest exporter of clothes, where violent protests over pay and conditions for thousands of mostly women workers are continuing. One woman has been killed and several others injured near Dhaka after clashes between police and factory workers demanding better wages. Crowds of workers returned to the streets a day after rejecting a new pay increase. And police there say they fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse protesters who were blocking roads and throwing stones. Our South Asia regional editor Ambrosena Natarajan has spent time with the workers over a number of years, and he told me about the conditions they're living in.
These women, they form the backbone of the garments industry in Bangladesh. Its garments industry is the lifeline of the economy. We are talking about 4 million people. These are from rural areas of Bangladesh who were otherwise doing agriculture work or any manual labour. So this has transformed the country in the last 30, 35 years. Now, when they come to places like Dhaka, they don't have housing. So they have to go and stay in a slum or with shanty towns, tin roof houses. There's no running water. And then they have to work for like 10 to 12 hours. They come back and cook for the families. Again, get up early, cook. In case if they have children, they have to go to school. So life is not easy.
It's not just about the money, is it? It's also about working conditions. I mean, what else do they want?
One is working conditions inside the factories. Two, safety. Many factories met with accidents. There are fire accidents. Hundreds of workers have been killed. And they want an increase in the salary three times. Because in the last 5 years, the food prices have tripled. That is why the workers are on the streets protesting outside Dhaka, asking for this $205 minimum wage a month.
Is the government broadly receptive to what they want?
I've spoken to many of the garment factory owners. The first thing they will say is, if the Western global fashion brands, if they can offer more, even 10 cents, 15 cents per T-shirt, then we can pass it on to the workers. Now, why orders are moving from China to Bangladesh is because of the low cost of labor. For example, in China, the same work, the worker might be getting about $350 a month, whereas now the Bangladeshi workers are talking about $75 to $80. So campaign groups like Clean Clothes Campaign from the Netherlands, they would argue that in the name of what they call cheap fashion or the fast fashion, people are buying clothes because they are very cheap. If you go to Oxford Street, one of the busiest shopping areas in Europe, you will find many fashion brands having clothes from made in Bangladesh. And these are the women, they stitch these clothes. You can buy a jeans down in Oxford Street for $6 or $10. And that is the debate, whether even people in the West, whether they should be paying more for the product. And that will have an impact in the quality of life of the workers in Bangladesh.
Ambrosena Natarajan speaking to me. The British insurance market Lloyd's of London has said it is deeply sorry after a report concluded it had played a significant role in the historic transatlantic slave trade. Lloyd's has announced a fund of more than $60 million to help affected communities and boost black and minority ethnic recruitment. Here's our business reporter, Sam Gruitt.
After protests swept the world in 2020 following the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died in police custody in the US, pressure mounted on companies to address links to slavery and tackle racial inequality. Lloyd's of London apologised for its historical connections to the slave trade and commissioned an independent report. Around 12 to 15 million people were taken by force from Africa to be used as slaves in the Caribbean, North, Central and South America between the 15 and 1800s. The report says Lloyd's, established in 1688, played a significant role in making the transatlantic slave trade possible. The Lloyd's chairman, Bruce Carnegie Brown, said he was committed to tackling inequalities, promising to spend £40 million on helping communities who are impacted, as well as £12 million on boosting black and minority ethnic recruitment. The race equality think tank, the Runnymede Trust, welcomed Lloyd's work in acknowledging past mistakes, but questioned its commitment, highlighting Lloyd's ethnicity pay gap, which is 21.5% for black employees.
Sam Gruitt. Now, before we finish, a cracking story of pet rescue for you. A dog in Britain has been hailed a hero after she sniffed out her owner's cat, who was stuck 30 metres below ground in a mineshaft. Mowgli had been missing for 6 days when Daisy, the Springer Spaniel, picked up his scent while out on a walk. Jane Prendergast has more.
Mowgli's owner, Michelle Rose, said she'd almost given up hope of finding him alive. But then she saw her dog Daisy going berserk in some woods near their home.
She had her nose to the ground in a way I've not seen her do before, and then shot up through the woods and then came back to find me. She was persistent in making me follow her.
When Michelle called for Mowgli, she heard him in the mineshaft. He was rescued the next day, unhurt, despite his ordeal. Daisy, she says, is the dog who can do no wrong and the hero of the day.
Cat dog heroics with Jane Prendergast there. Okay, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Oblakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Ever wondered what the world's wealthiest people did to get so ridiculously rich? Our billionaire this episode is the founder of co-working company WeWork, Adam Newman.
At its peak, WeWork was worth $47 billion. And Adam had a lot of fun getting to that point. He spent $20,000 on tequila and made people do shots during business meetings.
His modest aspirations, including wanting to live forever, to become the world's first trillionaire and expand his company to Mars. What we learned in the last couple of weeks is, in reality, he oversaw one of the most spectacular business failures in modern history. So is he good, bad, or just another billionaire?
To find out, listen to Good Bad Billionaire wherever you get your podcasts.